Colonel Rob Maness has a lifelong record of providing dedicated service to this nation. Having worked his way up from the enlisted ranks to full colonel, he served our country for more than 32 years. He has served as a bomber squadron commander, bomb disposal technician, Joint Chiefs of Staff Operations Officer, assisted the National Security Team with the campaign plan for the Global War on Terrorism. He authored the first theater nuclear war plan and served as the vice commander of America's largest airborne intelligence wing. Colonel Rob Maness is a true American hero. This is Rob Maness Live.
And I, a 3-week trial because I didn't do anything wrong. A federal judge, who I mentioned before, adjudicating my case, issues this 93-page opinion I have right here, 93 pages. And he threw out the case and he said, you're acquitted. And not only are you acquitted, but you're guaranteed a new trial in case the government appeals it. And I just want to read a couple quotes because they're pretty damning. He said such things as, quote, the evidence weighs so heavily in favor of the defendant that it would be unjust to enter judgment against him, end quote. Quote, the government did not carry its burden and no reasonable jury could have so concluded, end quote. And I mean, it goes on and on and on. He said, there can, of course, be no crimes if the defendant complied with those rules. I mean, 93 pages of that, of just castigating the government, saying they shouldn't have brought this case. The AMA, the American Medical Association, wrote an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief on my behalf, saying that the rules the government was coming after me for breaking, the AMA wrote those rules and I didn't break those rules. The very people who wrote the rules came to my defense and said he didn't break those rules, as did the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, said the same thing. You know, this was a global pandemic, right? Everybody was worried they were going to die. It was like trauma surgery. Every single day we had patients overwhelming us. One of our sites, we would open at 8 a.m. We'd have people lining up at 4 o'clock in the morning. We had to hire off-duty police officers because the line was a mile down the road with cars. Literally, I'm not exaggerating. Oh my God. I videotaped it. A mile. It was crazy. And now the government's coming after this, coming after me for this nonsense that makes no sense, that, you know, the judge threw the whole thing out and said it was ridiculous. But then as they're taping their boxes to leave their offices because Trump is about to be inaugurated, the Biden DOJ appealed it. So now the case is kind of moving forward and is on a path to a new trial in August. So I have to go through this horror show yet again in August.
Welcome back to the Rob Maness Show. It's Truth Thursday again, and we're live on Worldview Tube and X-Spaces Simulcast. We just saw what they did to Dr. Ron Elfenbein, a board-certified emergency medicine physician who simply tried to save lives during the COVID nightmare. Folks, this isn't about public health. This is medical crime weaponization by the Department of Justice. It's all about the big money. Big Pharma made billions of dollars pushing a one-size-fits-all vaccine narrative while cheap early treatments were deliberately smeared, censored, and buried. And even the ones that we came up with, people got attacked for supporting them. The Department of Justice was turned into a weapon against doctors who refused to fall into line. They called it fraud when it was nothing more than frontline medicine. It's never been about the science. It's always been about control and the cash. Hundreds of billions of dollars in contracts, kickbacks, and government mandates that crushed independent physicians and small pharmacies while the big players got richer. That's why they had to discredit every alternative treatment to the vaccine and silence the voices that stood in the gap. And today we're pulling the curtain all the way back. Dr. Ron, is welcome back to the show, my friend. It's great to have you with us again. Let's get into what's recently going on. But first, that clip didn't tell the folks what you were charged with. Tell them real quick what you were charged with that led to that judge saying, this is baloney.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me, Colonel. It's good to see you again, and it's good to be back with you. And big shout out to Shell. She's awesome. So thank you both for having me. So the real quick, I was a... I was a big proponent of the monoclonal antibodies during COVID, and I was very outspoken about that. I had a bunch of clinics that I started to help treat people and test people, and the government essentially came after me for a coding dispute. So it was basically ICD-10 is the coding book that we use, if you will, and there are over 69,000 codes that you can pick from in that ICD-10 volume, and they said we picked the wrong one. And they charged me with 5 counts of healthcare fraud for patients that I hadn't even seen, that we had nurse practitioners and PAs see. And the government hadn't even reviewed the charts, and they never even had, throughout the entirety of this trial against me, up until the trial, they never had a professional coder whose job it is to determine the level of coding. They never had anybody look at the charts other than government prosecutors, which is just mind-boggling to me, but that's what they did. And they never said why what we did was wrong or how what we did was wrong or even what the right code should have been. They just said we were wrong, which is also mind-boggling. So they charged me with 5 counts, which carried with it up to 50 years, 50 years in jail and millions of dollars in restitution. And what's crazy is if you really think about the coding level, from what we picked was called the level four. We don't have to get into it, but we picked a level four and we had very good rationale for doing that. But if you go to the next lowest level, it's a level three. The difference on average between those two billing wise is about $50. I Googled it. So it's about $50. So you're talking about throwing me in jail for 50 years and millions of dollars in fines and restitution over $250 over a billing dispute? Like it's an absolute and utter insanity. And I can't explain it other than the fact that there are ulterior motives here. And it's not about billing and it's not about coding and it's certainly not about fraud. It's about other things.
So $250, that means five instances.
So over the relevant time frame of the indictment, there we saw my clinics. There were eight of them. Essentially, we had eight clinics up and running. We went from one before the pandemic to eight during the pandemic because we were so overwhelmed. And frankly, if I could have built another 50, I would have if I had the resources to do that because we were helping people and we were curing people. But we saw over 100,000 patients in that time frame, and they chose five. And typically, when you talk about healthcare fraud, you're talking about, or fraud in general, things that are billed for that don't actually exist, right? Like the Learning Center, where they had supposedly hundreds of kids and there was never a child in the building. Well, these are the charts of the patients that they indicted me over. Their names have been redacted, but these are the charts. They're actual people, real human beings.
Real
In
people.
fact, real people. The government called three of them at trial, mind-blowing. I don't know why they did, but they did. And these people put their hands up and they said, yes, I'm a human being. I exist. I got seen. I got tested. Where is the fraud? How is this fraud? It's crazy.
So this co the reason the federal government's involved, let me make sure that folks understand this, is that these codes, are they Medicare codes or how is it tied to the federal law?
It's they're universally used by both Medicare and private insurance. So it's both. So they basically said that we were upcharging, charging too much money, essentially using too high of a code. So it went across the line between Medicare and private insurance companies. Yeah, I mean the whole
It
thing is
just
just crazy and mind-boggling. And I think the reason that they came after me, again, isn't even the judge in a pretrial conference said this whole thing looks like a case of, quote, shoot first and ask questions later, because they hadn't really done any investigation. I spoke out publicly. I was very much in favor, as you said in your opening monologue, of an alternative treatment, the monoclonal antibodies, which was the cure for COVID. We could cure somebody's COVID in 30 minutes. You would get an infusion, comes in a little vial, you inject it into a bag of saline, and you drip it into somebody's arm over 30 minutes. And then we watch you for 30 minutes. And you are cured at that point of your disease. I'm telling you, I've seen people who were blue in the face, like they couldn't breathe. They came in, they got this treatment. Within an hour, they were like walking out. And they were like, this is unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it in my entire career in medicine. This stuff worked and it was miraculous. Even the federal government even came to me and said, we want you, because you're good at this, to open up a site at FedEx Field in Landover, Maryland, where the Redskins, the Commanders now, but the Redskins play football. So in partnership with HHS, the Health and Human Services Department of the federal government, I opened up a site between my company, HHS, and the Maryland Department of Health. They called me And we were the largest supplier in the entire Mid-Atlantic region of monoclonal antibodies. We had people coming from West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Virginia, New Jersey, New York, because they couldn't get it anywhere else because the government was limiting the supply. We were supplying it. And then the Biden administration politicized the whole thing, and I spoke out about it. And then they shut the whole program down, and I spoke out even louder. And then I get indicted.
Yeah, it's a... So the monoclonal antibodies that we were using in the pandemic, just to refresh everybody, those were emergency use authorized drugs too, right?
Yes. So like great question, Colonel. And I appreciate you bringing that up. So unlike the mRNA vaccine, which was a very, very new and untried technology, the technology involved in manufacturing and distributing and using monoclonal antibodies has been around for like 50 years. We use it for all sorts of things in medicine. It's a tried and proven technique, and it's a tried and proven medication. Now, these individual ones were awarded emergency use authorization because they had not had the time to go through FDA, you know, clearance and everything else. But regardless, it's not some crazy new technology that never been tried. You know, this is a tried and true method of treatment for autoimmune diseases, certain cancers. They're looking at it for Alzheimer's disease, you know, all sorts of infectious diseases. So it works. And it's not some crazy fly-by-night technology.
So why did they stop? Because they stopped using it. They forced people to stop using it, right?
Yes, they did. Well, so first, it was, like I said, I've never seen anything like it. So just to back up a little bit, we became the largest supplier, as I said, in the Mid-Atlantic region. And it's not because I'm some genius and some, you know, ridiculous business acumen. It's because they made it so onerous for people to get it that nobody was prescribing it. So we had this wonderful cure that was made so difficult to get that nobody was getting it.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean, if I see you in the emergency room, I'm an ER doctor. If you come to me, Colonel, and I said to you, listen, you're COVID positive, you're sick, I think you should get this. What I would have to do to get you that medication was to go to a separate website, fill out a 3 or 4 page document, which would take me probably 20 to 30 minutes, print it out, manually fax it. God knows why, but I had to fax it to some number in the hopes that somebody would eventually call you and schedule you for an appointment. Now, no one got paid to do that, right? And nobody had the time to do that. So it didn't get done. Nobody was getting this life-saving medicine. So I said, okay, well, that's the pain point. So I set up a call center, and I hired a bunch of people, and I trained them what to say and how to go through an algorithm of questions and make sure the patient's qualified. And then we had a schedule, and I said, just put them on the schedule. And all of a sudden, I went around to all the ERs in the area and all the primary care doctor's offices in the area, and I handed them my card. I said, when someone's positive and they're symptomatic, hand them our card. We will take care of all the hard work. And that's exactly what happened. We were bigger than Johns Hopkins, bigger than University of Maryland. All these major academic centers weren't giving it. And the other thing that's so crazy, Colonel, is that this medicine was truly a life-saving medicine, but it was contraindicated in somebody who got admitted to the hospital. And I never understood that. Nobody could answer to my question, well, why aren't we giving this to inpatients? Why do you have to be an outpatient to get it? It never made any sense. The only thing they would offer them in the hospital was remdesivir. You could not get monoclonal antibodies if you were admitted to the hospital.
And you don't know why. To this day,
I do not understand, except that there was some ulterior motive involved here. And I think the whole reason behind all this is that they came after me and that all this stuff was made so difficult to get was because it worked. And Secretary Kennedy came out and said multiple times in multiple podcasts that there is a little known provision in the federal law allowing emergency use authorizations that if there is anything else proven to be efficacious against a virus for which there is a vaccine that has an emergency use authorization, that EUA is put in direct risk of being revoked because there's something else that works. Therefore, the emergency use authorization should not be in place because it's an experimental medicine and that will be taken away. So this monoclonals, that's why they had to go after ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine so strongly. But I would argue that the monoclonal antibodies were even more efficacious than those two medicines. This would cure somebody in 30 minutes, one dose, one time.
That's what I heard about it. I mean, if I had gotten sick with it early on, I would have been after the antibodies.
That's what President Trump got.
The remdesivir is nicknamed Run, Death is Near, is what that's nicknamed, I've heard. I've done a show on that. So I wonder how many people would be alive that went into those hospitals today had they been able to get it. We got to take a break, Doc. When we come back, we'll see another little clip of you. Later on, we will see Secretary Kennedy talking about why they were doing this and that little known piece of the law you were speaking about. But in the next segment, I want to talk about it's not fraud. It's really not fraud. I want to dive into that in detail. And we've got a question in the audience that we'll get asked to. We'll be right back. Dr. Ron Elfenbein.
Well, is it going to be done?
Yeah. So I'm trying to get a hold of the weaponization task force. They don't have a website and they don't have anyone to call. So I'm trying to get a hold of Todd Blanche, who now became the, you know, the was the deputy attorney general, now became the attorney general. And he's the chair of this task force. But I don't have his phone number. I did speak to a United States senator who was behind me. I spoke to a secretary in the cabinet who's behind me. You know, I'm at a loss. I don't know what to do. I can't explain why they're still coming after me. I think it's just the right hand isn't talking to the left hand. The case was started under Biden, DOJ, and it's just continuing.
Yeah. Have you tried Hermeet Dhillon?
Again, I don't have a direct line to her. So if somebody knows how to get a hold of her, I'd really much appreciate getting in touch with these people because, you know, this case is so crazy and it doesn't make any sense. And it nearly bankrupted me. My wife's a physician as well. She's a peds oncologist at a major academic center. And she treats kids with cancer. Thank God she was still working because I couldn't work for 2 years. You know, it nearly bankrupted me. It like destroyed my life. I have 4 children. This weaponization is awful.
Welcome back to the Rob Mayer Show. And that man right there, Dr. Ron Elfenbein, is my guest today again, because there's been some developments in the case. And you just heard him talking about the Weaponization Watch Task Force. And I think that interview was about 7 or 8 days ago. It wasn't that long ago, which is why I wanted to use it. Ron, have you been able to reach Acting Attorney General Blanche or somebody that's working for him on the task force or Hermeet Dhillon at this point?
I have not personally. I just realized too. I guess I should get some different colored scrubs because it's the same. We're in the same scrub top. I have not. But interestingly, I have a gentleman that I've become friendly with over X, who I've got to know through a bunch of spaces we did together and stuff. And he called me the other day and he said that he was volunteering for the GOP in Northern Virginia, and I'm not going to name the person's name, but a certain individual walked right by him who's pretty high up in the government. And he said, "Hey, can I talk to you for a minute?" And he was, "Of course you can talk to me." And they sat there and they talked for 15 minutes about my case. And that individual reached out to me over X and followed me. And we still haven't spoken yet, but that's just because he's an incredibly busy person. But we're trying back and forth. I say that because you never know who's paying attention and you never know who's listening. So if somebody out there has a way to get in touch with Todd Blanche, Attorney General Blanche, or Deputy Attorney General Hermeet Dhillon, or anybody else, please let me know, because it's very hard to get a hold of those people. But yes, I mean, I'm trying every single day to get these people's ear, because this case just is crazy. And it's a clear case of weaponization. And I think that's what the task force was set up to do, was to find cases like mine.
Yeah, especially from the last administration who made it an art form. Weaponization of the United States government and government really at all levels You know, as the president was charged at the state level by a couple of different state attorney generals at the behest of the Biden administration in more than one occasion. You know, so yeah, you would think that they would be taking a really hard look at this case. So your case, the status of it is what?
So I am scheduled for a new trial as of August, although I believe we're working on a continuance right now to try to push that date back for various reasons. But as of now, as of right this second, it's scheduled for the beginning of August, which would be criminal trial number two for me, the worst experience of my life that I would never wish upon another soul as long as I live. I don't care what you did. I would never wish this kind of thing upon anybody. It's the worst experience I've ever had in my life. And well, I suppose there are people who deserve it, but I think you know what I mean. Yeah. And I can't imagine going through this yet again. I did nothing wrong. This whole thing is insane. And it's like I said in that clip, it's nearly bankrupted myself and my family. And yeah. It's certainly destroyed my health and my family's health and our mental status and our mental well-being. And I mean, everything you can think of, it's just wrecked. And that's, they know that. They know that that's a good part of what they're doing. And that, and you know, I would think that they should be a little more careful before they pull the trigger, but to ruin somebody's life like this, but clearly they don't, you know, that's not what they think about.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the process is the punishment. You know, it's interesting because they're whining a whole lot about James Comey's second indictment and the Southern Poverty Law Center indictment, and those kind of things. Now that, power of the federal justice department is coming for their side. So let me just make sure I understand this, Ron. The judge acquitted you, but you're being retried?
Yeah. In fact, here's the acquittal. It's a 90, I keep it next to me. It's 93 pages.
Yeah.
And he acquitted me of all charges and said that there was, I mean, I'm paraphrasing obviously, but essentially said there was no evidence and essentially that the case should never have been brought. And he really went after the government multiple times, and rightly so.
Yeah.
Obviously in a judicial way, and I can't come out and say it like that, but he, if you read between the lines, that's what he's saying. Mm-hmm. And not only did he acquit me, but then he also said, just in case the government appeals, I'm going to grant you a new trial. So I'm guaranteed a new trial. So then literally, as I said, in that clip with Dr. Drew, as they were boxing up their boxes, their offices to leave to, because Trump's about to come into office, the Biden people decided to appeal this. And now I'm facing a second criminal trial. And I just, you know, what's, I just realized this, someone posted about this yesterday, you know, like the Sackler family, the Purdue pharmaceuticals, the people who basically caused this entire, or at least partially caused this entire opioid crisis that we're going through. Yeah. They just, they got indicted. Their company got indicted. None of them are facing jail time. None of them are facing personal retribution. Their company got fined, but that's it. And yet they're coming after me for quote unquote, picking the wrong code during a global pandemic when the world is shut down. Mm-hmm. They never had the courtesy to just pick up the phone and say, if this was really about a coding issue, hey, Dr. Elfenbein, we have a question about your coding. Could you come in and explain it to us? They never did that. Yeah. Again, like, you know, Colonel, if you're at a shopping center and you think you got overcharged, what do? You call the feds? No, you ask to speak to the checkout person and say, I think you overcharged me. Can we talk about this? Right. That's what any reasonable person would do. But that's not what the government did.
Yeah.
They just
usually
decided to come out with a sledgehammer.
Yeah. And usually with the fraud, you have victims, but they brought in patients that confirmed that you were doing the right thing. So it's kind of weird that. Let's take this question from the audience. Go ahead, Shel.
Dr. Ron, we have a question from the audience. Did all this coding start after Obamacare? White Hat is asking.
That's a good question. So it's a hard question to answer. It didn't start after Obamacare. It really started with Medicare. So in the 1960s, when Medicare was enacted, that's when all this stuff started to come about. And then the coding began in like the late 70s, early 80s with ICD-1. So the AMA is actually the group who puts this all out. And the AMA actually makes a lot of money off of these ICD-10 codes. It's now we're off to the 10th iteration. So that's why it's ICD-10. It was ICD-1. Now it's ICD-10. And these codes are used internationally. So it's not just the United States, but they're used all over the world. So Obamacare made it worse, but Obamacare did not enact the ICD-10 system that we use, but it's a good question.
Yeah, it is a great question. And these codes are used by insurance companies, they're used by hospitals, individual doctors, right? I mean, it's how the system is supposed to be controlled so people aren't overcharged. Is that right?
I mean, sort of. So the way the process works is if you came to see me in my office, Colonel, and I saw you, I would submit the bill to your insurance company, but you don't actually submit a chart. People don't know that, but you just submit the patient's name and the codes that go with that, with the bill. Mm-hmm. So if the insurance company wants to see the chart, they have to specifically request it. They have to do what's called a chart audit or call us and say, hey, we'd like to see, you know, so-and-so's chart. Could you please send it to us? And what's crazy about this whole thing is, again, these charts, these five counts that they charged me with, the government never even saw these until after they indicted me. So that's like saying, we know you overcharged us. We don't have a bill of sale, so we don't know for sure, but we know you did it anyway, and we're going to charge you with the crime without actually looking at the charts, because the billing is all based on what's in the charts. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I can't explain that. It just makes no sense. It's totally illogical. But they did it. And I know that they didn't have the charts because I didn't turn them over to them. Mm-hmm. They subpoenaed them, but I didn't turn them over until after the indictment. So, yes, the coding, the codes kind of determine how much you bill. But there's 69,000 codes that you can pick from.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I can't put it into any other words. It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's more than mind-boggling, Doc. It's more than mind-boggling, man. I'm telling you, it's so. I lost my train of thought on my question I had for you. Let's go back to the audience. We got one more in the audience. Let's go ahead and take that.
We have Wib, sir.
Thank you, Shell. Thank you, Colonel. Thank you, Doctor. These ICD-10 codes, to piggyback on Shell's question, are these the same codes that hospitals were using fraudulently to make people that came in and died of car accidents, they would recode them to be they died of COVID and therefore got extra money from the government?
Yep, it's the same coding system. And like I said, if you think about over 69,000 of these codes, I mean, literally there's a code for like, I tripped over a duck. I mean, that's how stupid some of these codes are. But yes, to your point, yes, this is the exact coding system that was used for all of that. And the government specifically told us for patient, this is from government fiat. They said, when you're testing a patient for COVID, you are to use the diagnosis code of exposure to COVID. There is a rule out code, which we do for a lot of things. Like if someone comes in with chest pain, we may use a code for rule out heart attack. But they specifically said there's a rule out code for COVID. Do not use the rule out code. We were specifically told, do not use that code. Use the exposure to COVID. That's what they told us to use, which means that everybody has been exposed to COVID. Because if they come in, that's what we're supposed to diagnose them with, exposure to COVID. And that's what we did.
Well, isn't that kind of fraudulent in itself? Not that you did it, but that their policies made you do it.
I understand your question. I mean, you know, I chalked it up at the time to the thinking that we didn't know who had it and who didn't, because there was, you know, this period where you could be asymptomatic, yet positive. And it's a great question, Colonel. I mean, I suppose that yeah. But we were specifically told, don't use this other code because it won't be billed. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to get paid if you use the other code. So. Yeah. Maybe that's an element of, you know, of them stacking the deck and making more, you know, the numbers look worse than they really were. I don't know. It's a good question.
Well, there was a lot of money flowing, you know, and you know, hospitals are getting more money if somebody died with COVID than if they didn't, because they took them in and it was incentivized. And, you know, that's something that I would want my Department of Justice to be looking at and going after, not for the individual doctor, but the policy set by the administration of a hospital that's driving that. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, I want them to look at that kind of stuff. But what they're doing to you is the exact opposite. They're going after something really small that makes no sense. That's actually legal, trying to follow the right procedure and the right directives. But you get the hammer. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of, it's like a bizarro world, to use a
it's Kafka-esque. Superman term. That's how I describe it, or bizarro world. Yes.
Yeah. Behind the looking glass, we would call that in the military, in the nuclear world, behind the looking glass, you know, you're Alice in Wonderland now. We got to take another break, Doc. When we come back, we will see the clip about the fraud being fake on your charge, et cetera. This time I had the wrong clip. And I want to talk about that and talk about just exactly who you are, because you've won awards. You were like all over the media trying to help people get treatment for the pandemic. And the government was asking you to do it. You kind of mentioned it with the RFK Stadium thing already, but I want to dive into that too and talk about this and why it's fake. We'll be right back with Dr. Ron Elfenbein.
News is moving faster than ever, and so are we. Worldview Tube brings you 24/7 live stream coverage, and now, real-time alerts when it matters most. Once you have the Worldview Tube app installed, exit the app and navigate your way to settings. In settings, locate the tab labeled Notifications. Select the Notifications tab. Scroll down until you locate the Worldview Tube app icon. Select the tab, and here you can turn on and customize your notification experience for the Worldview Tube app. News doesn't wait, and neither should you. Turn on push notifications to stay informed, every headline as it happens.
To John's point, I think that's a great point. And he's right that the president has now said that the task force has to meet daily. And, you know, their job is to look for cases exactly like mine. And this could be a win for the administration. They could look at this and say, there's real fraud going on in the world. This is not real fraud. Real healthcare fraud, Dr. Drew, as you know, is when patients don't exist and things get done that never get billed for that were never done. That is not this case. Nobody is alleging that. In fact, the government called 3 of the 5 patients at trial, and they all testified, yes, I got seen by a provider. Yes, I got 2 tests. Yes, I had my vital signs taken. They were all real people. Like, this is not healthcare fraud. This is insane.
Welcome back to the Rob Manish Show. It's Truth Thursday, and Dr. Ron Elfenbein is back with us as there's been developments in the case and in the situation around what he's been charged with. And, Doc, you know, I've looked at that clip right there like 10 times. Since you did that show, including a couple times this morning, and it just, I just don't understand it. I do not understand what's going on with the people that we now have in charge of this. Are you having any problems with things like discovery, those kinds of issues with the prosecutors? I mean, is your team, your counsel talking with the prosecutors now? And why haven't they just submitted a dismissal with prejudice motion?
Well, I can't really get into the legal haranguing, but they said that they really need a reason to do that, and the government is free to retry me if they choose to. So there's no, despite the fact that they have no evidence, they presented no evidence at trial. I mean, again, the 93-page opinion, it's not just me saying this. They really presented no evidence. They didn't. And you can't ask the judge to drop the case because they didn't present any evidence, which is just crazy too. I think you should be able to, but apparently you can't. Yeah. So unfortunately I'm still stuck in this quagmire of this whole thing. And I think, look, Donald Trump, when he got COVID in his first term, he got monoclonal antibodies. I think he knew about my case, he would be the first one to be like, this is crazy. Free this guy, like, stop this. But, you know, it's just the right hand just having no clue what the left hand is doing. And this snowball kind of started under Biden, and it's just rolling down the hill faster and faster. And I think they knew what they were doing. They knew by starting, and it's really hard to stop it. And I just have to find that one person who can be the champion to say, this is crazy. This is not a just prosecution. It's already been adjudicated, for God's sakes. We've already spent millions of dollars on both sides over this.
Yeah.
Just stop it. Walk away from it. There's real fraud out there. Go prosecute those people. Like, why are you going to...
That's one of the things I'm worried about. We talked about it in the last segment. I mean, there is real, no kidding, fraud, especially in the pandemic side, to look into. But we run it. We keep running into these cases where they've glommed on to the fake fraud. And they go after people on the fake fraud. I mean, I had a case on last week on a PPP loan that makes no sense with Chris Mazzei and his wife.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Yep.
You know,
yep.
Great Terrible. Guy. Same kind of thing, though. It's like they're going after the little people who were trying to follow the right process and the right procedures. And might have made an error, or it, like in your case, it's a disagreement on the code that amounts to about $50 difference, and it's absolutely nuts. And here's one of the things that makes it really weird with you in particular, Doc, and that is that didn't you win like several awards over all of this? What were they?
Yeah, so thank you for asking. So I was awarded a personal citation by our former governor, Larry Hogan, who came to me, to my one of my clinics personally, and handed me this really nice award. And it's a personal citation from the governor for all the work that you did during COVID and your bravery and all the rest of this. And then the Maryland State Legislature voted and did the same thing. And then the State Medical Society named me essentially its Person of the Year. Even after I got indicted, I still was awarded this. I was on the front cover of my alma mater, my medical school. Like, it was called the COVID Crusader, and they had this whole book about about what I was doing, and they put it out to all the, you know, they were very proud of the fact that one of their graduates was doing the right things, took his oath seriously, stepped up, tried to save as many lives as I could. And as I said before, I opened up 3 monoclonal centers. If I could have opened up 50, I would have. I just couldn't do it. But, you know, because it was saving people's lives. And I literally lived off of my cell phone for 2 years. I didn't see my family. I didn't sleep. I didn't eat. I was running around like a lunatic for 2 years trying to do as much as I could, because I was like, this is what I signed up for. This is like, this is what I took an oath for. Now is the time to step up. If there's ever a time in my life as a doctor, this is it. And I really meant that, and I really took that seriously. And the thanks that I got from the federal government was to destroy my life. Like, I just, you know, complete opposite of what the state said and the people that know me. And again, they reached out to me to go into business together. Like, would you go into business with someone you think is committing fraud? I mean, it was crazy.
But by they, you mean the federal government, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The federal government. They came to me and said, can we start? Could you help us? Could you do this? And interestingly, about that site. So we set up the site at FedEx Field. Mm-hmm. And I had to convince them that we should test there as well. They didn't want to test. And I said, no, we should test. And they said, well, why would you want to test there too? I said, because if somebody's positive and they're symptomatic, they're not going to get lost to follow up. We can take them right from their car, put them right in an infusion chair, and give them monoclonal antibodies and cure them right then and there. And they were like, this is the greatest idea ever. And that became the model going forward for the entire country. So we were kind of groundbreaking, and we set up what was going to happen for the entire nation. And then they turn around and then they destroy my life. And I wrote a book about COVID, how to survive COVID for the layperson, and I gave it away for free. Like, does that sound like someone who's just trying to make money and trying to rip off people? Like, I gave it away for free. It was posted on pretty much every platform you could find, and it was just a free ebook. I spent a lot of time on it, but I was like, just, you know, it's going to help people. I'll give it away for free.
It doesn't sound like somebody that's trying to make money. Although you should make money in your profession, you know, I think most people won't argue with that and don't have a problem with a doctor making a good living kind of things.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, Colonel, the United States government certainly seems to, because at my trial, so in order to prove somebody's guilt, the government has to prove 2 elements of a crime. They have to prove intent, and they have to prove there was an actual crime. So to prove quote unquote criminal intent, they put up my tax returns and they just showed the jury, look how much money he made before COVID. Look how much money he made during COVID. And of course, there is a discrepancy there. I will be the first to say it. And did I make money? Yes. We saw 100,000 patients in a single year. Of course I made money. It wasn't that much money, but I made money. Mm-hmm. But that's what they used to convince the jury that I committed fraud. My tax returns. Unbelievable. Mm. But that's what they did.
So do you know of those 100,000 patients in a year? Do you have data on them? You know, how many of them might have died from COVID later? How many of them actually were positive? You gave them monoclonals and it saved them. That kind of statistic.
I don't, and the government took my business, so I no longer have access to our electronic health record. But I can tell you that I have a dear friend of mine who's become a dear friend of mine. He's a gentleman who owns seven assisted living centers, and he reached out to me during COVID, and he called me one night, and he said, you know, I'm trying to put my three-year-old to bed, and he calls me, and he's like, listen, I own seven centers. My patients are dying, and I really, I want to do something about it. I'm like, listen, sir, I'm trying to put my kid to bed. What do you need? And he's like, I heard you supply monoclonal antibodies. Can you help us? I'm like, absolutely. I'll help you tomorrow. What do you need? And the line went dead. And I said, are you there? And he said, yes, you're the 27th. And I'm not joking. The 27th person I've called to try to get some help here. And you're the only one who said he could help me. And I'm like, I'll tell you what, I'm going to have my operations manager reach out to you first thing in the morning, and we'll schedule it, and we'll get your patients done. Every single day from then on that we were open, he had a little bus. He would bring patients in his little bus with a driver. They would bring them to us, and we would infuse them. And then his driver got sick. We infused the driver. He ended up getting sick. We infused him. And he tells me, I meet with him probably once or twice a month. He's a dear friend now. And he says to me, every single person without fail, including a 103-year-old patient who was on death's door that he brought to us, survived. Every single patient who went to the hospital did not. Now, that's anecdotal data. I get that. But, you know, you're talking hundreds of people, and he swears by it. And he says, every single person without fail that got the monoclonal antibodies from you survived. And every single person who went to the hospital to get treated ended up dying.
Yeah. That's, see, I mean, there's a fraud piece that I want investigated. I've been talking about it for years. Is that why are people going to the hospital and dying initially in this? And why do we have these horror stories from parents of young patients, children of older patients, and, you know, all these horror stories about you can't even go in and say goodbye. Putting them on a respirator. They can't talk, you know, and all of that has never really been looked into from my perspective. Not enough to where people are held accountable. Am I right on that?
100%. As a doctor, it was heartbreaking because in the emergency room, I would be, you know, even if it was like a heart attack, right? And the person's going to go to the, you know, the cath lab to have a cardiac catheterization or something, and they want their loved one there, we were not allowed to bring them back. That was the hospital policy. And, you know, so I had to be the one to tell them this. And I'm like, I'm sorry, your family can't come back. Or, you know, grandma's dying and someone wants to say goodbye. No, they can't. I mean, it was heartbreaking to have to tell people this. And you brought it up before, the remdesivir. You know, just so your audience understands, that was the medicine that came about as an antiviral to treat Ebola. And it was so toxic that even treating Ebola, which has anywhere between a 50 and a 90% mortality rate, they stopped using it because it was so toxic and didn't work. So why the hell were we bringing it back for COVID when we had something, these monoclonal antibodies that would cure people, but we were not allowed to use them in the hospital and out of the hospital? They did everything they could to keep people from getting them.
It makes absolutely no sense, Doc. You know, from a medical perspective, look, in my previous life as an Air Force commander, I had oversight over large clinics that were once hospitals. They're still the same kind of concept, but they changed the name of them. So hundreds of medical providers and professionals understand HIPAA, understand the HSI inspections, and all of the regulations that go with this. And it doesn't make sense to me at all. As somebody that's been responsible for those types of facilities, for what those decisions those people are making, you know, and saving lives, it absolutely makes no sense to me. I can't believe that I'm here years later talking about it with somebody that is still being oppressed by a Department of Justice that we're supposed to have been fixing it. It's really disappointing.
Yes, and just to take it a little bit further, so not only did it make it difficult to get, But then the administration actually came out and said, well, we're going to politicize it. So then they started limiting who was going to get it. And it just so happened that red states couldn't get monoclonal antibodies. And then they said, we're going to start using this term equity, which nobody can define for me. I have no idea what the hell that word means. And it certainly has no place in medicine, but they started using the term equity to determine who was going to get this life-saving medication. So you had Florida, for example. There was a massive outbreak in 2021 in Florida, and the feds cut Florida off. They said, you're not getting any more monoclonal antibodies. Ron DeSantis, thank God for him, had to go out and use Floridian taxpayer dollars to go out and purchase the medication directly from the manufacturer, despite the fact that the feds had ample supply, which they controlled, because initially they didn't control. I could initially order it from the manufacturer directly, and I would get it. They paid for it, but I could just order whatever I needed, and I got it. The feds said, well, we're going to start controlling distribution. And overnight, you had artificial shortages. And then they cut states off that needed it. So you had people that were basically being consigned to either go to the hospital or die because the federal government just thought it was, quote unquote, unequitable to send it to them instead to send it somewhere else. I've never heard of that term before in terms of using a life-saving medicine. It's always about need.
Yeah.
And now the government's interjecting itself between the patient and the doctor, and totally inappropriate and unheard of. First time I've ever heard of something like this before in all of medicine. And then they shut the whole program down based on ridiculous nonsense. And that's when I really got mad and I went on Fox News and complained. And then they came after me.
Yeah, they came after you. And we'll talk about go deeper into those reasons why after this break, Doc. And coming back in, we'll hear from it. It's a long video, but it's very important to listen to it. Secretary of HHS Robert Kennedy Jr. We'll talk about the reasons why that all of this stuff was happening. We'll be right back with Dr. Ron Elfenbein.
You woke up with a sore throat and a low-grade fever. You know you are getting sick, so here's your choices. You can get sicker and miss work, try to see a doctor this week, or sit hours in a crowded waiting room at urgent care.
I have a smarter option for you. Open your medical emergency kit, match your symptoms to doctor-recommended prescription in your booklet, and take the right meds now and get well faster.
This is not a first aid kit. It's like having an urgent care in your home. It includes doctor-prescribed medications to treat over 39 medical issues like respiratory infections, strep throat, pneumonia, UTIs, and more.
No waiting to see the doctor and no standing in line at the pharmacy. It's right here.
Every home should have at least one medical emergency kit, and here's how to order.
Go to worldviewhealthcare.com. Your kit to treat dozens of common and serious illnesses is rushed to your door. worldviewhealthcare.com. That's worldviewhealthcare.com.
The emergency kit available at worldviewhealthcare.com. Make sure you don't have to go to urgent care. I got pneumonia. I didn't have to go. I took this last year. Stayed at home. Went to bed.
I'll say, you know, explain to your listeners that that people wonder why did we need to suppress ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine? These are well-established drugs with well-established safety profiles that have had billions of doses have been given. Ivermectin is a human drug. It also works on horses, but it won the Nobel Prize because it works so well on human beings. Tony Fauci's problem was this. There's a little known federal law that says you cannot give an emergency use authorization to a vaccine if there is any medication approved for any purpose that is shown effective against the target disease. So if Tony Fauci or anybody had admitted that hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin are effective against COVID, it would have been illegal for them to give the emergency use authorizations to the vaccines, and they could never have gotten them approved. And it would have been, you know, a $200 billion enterprise that would have collapsed.
That is fascinating. I mean, I have been covering this very closely now for all of the 2 years. That's the first I've heard that. I mean, in your book. So he would not have gotten emergency use authorization for the vaccine if the medical community had been saying ivermectin works. It is an effective treatment for COVID.
Well, the medical community, a lot of it was saying that. I mean, there's 17,000 doctors who've signed a petition, and there are, you know, there are so many peer-reviewed publications now that consistently say that, but he had to aggressively crusade against it to kind of drown out those reports by saying it's a horse medication, it's, you know, people are taking it and it's dangerous and it's overdosing people. And, you know,
well, why did he keep saying it? Why did he keep saying it after he got his authorization?
Well, one, even if you have the emergency use authorization, the law appears to say you can't have it anymore if there's a functioning medication. Hmm. Oh, you know, that may be why. Again, I try not to look in his head, but I do. There's a very, very strong incentive for him to kill ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. And, you know, there are many doctors, including Harvey Reich of Yale, who's one of the leading biostatisticians, epidemiologists in the world. Peter McCulloch, who is the most published doctor in the history of the world in his specialty. Pierre Corey, these doctors who've treated tens of thousands of COVID patients successfully, they consistently say, and the science supports this, that 500,000 Americans did not need to die.
Welcome back to the Rob Mena Show. We're live on Worldview Tube and our X Spaces simulcast. And my guest is Dr. Ron Elfenbein, who is a victim of weaponization and making crimes out of activities during the pandemic that were being hailed. He won awards. He was sought after to talk on local and national news shows. The government itself wanted to partner with him in his effort to get monoclonal antibodies to people that needed it to save their lives. And he's probably saved hundreds of thousands of lives by getting monoclonal antibodies to them. But then he spoke out. He spoke out, and that situation you were talking about right there, Dr. Ron, when you spoke out, you were saying we have a medication that's working. I guess Fauci and the crowd were afraid they would lose the EUA for the vaccine, which doesn't make any sense because the antibodies you were using were also EUA.
Yes, and I can't explain it, right? I mean, I'm trying to put together the things that make logical sense. So one, I went on national news, I went on Newsmax and Fox News, and I said that they're going to kill people and people are going to die. And that made them look silly. And that made them look foolish. And I called them out again and again and again. And I also began to question the vaccine narrative. Initially I was very pro-vaccine because I believed what I was told. But then I started to question, none of this made any sense. The science didn't make any sense. What they were saying didn't make any sense. The logic didn't make any sense. So I started to question that. And then I just lost it when they shut the whole program down. I'm like, people are going to die. And then when I thought about this whole EUA thing, I'm like, well, it certainly makes sense that this medicine will put the vaccine at risk of being pulled off the market. And they can't have that because, interestingly, the EUAs, as you point out, the EUAs for these various monoclonal antibodies very quickly started to go away. Meaning that they were pulled off the market. You can't get them anymore. They don't exist. You can't get them. Mm-hmm. So why would they do that? You have a medicine that's so efficacious and saves people's lives. Why would you take it off the market?
There was a lot of discussion about peer-reviewed studies on ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine and all that stuff. And peer-reviewed and masks and probably this antibodies stuff too. And they were all suppressed during this time period. And we know now that the vaccine is ineffective. And they still have people out there wanting to give it to people. It's ineffective. It doesn't stop you from getting it. It doesn't stop you from spreading it when you do get it, the disease itself. It is ineffective. It's the most horrendous thing I've ever seen. And it sounds a lot like the annual flu shot, which is very ineffective, you know, because that shot's made off of one particular strain of the flu. And there are a bunch of them, and they're just making a best guess at which strain's going to be the most powerful this year. And it's very ineffective. I stopped getting the flu shot years ago, and I've had the flu since.
Yeah, they force us to get it in the hospital. You have to get it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something. You know, to your point, Colonel, and to what Secretary Kennedy was saying, I tried to write for ivermectin, I think, 5 or 6 times during COVID for patients that I would, friends of mine, basically, who tested positive, without fail. And the only reason I did it was 5 or 6 times was because of this. Mm-hmm. Every single time I wrote that prescription out, I got a call from a pharmacist on the other end saying, what's the ICD-10 code associated with this patient? And I will tell you, I have been practicing emergency medicine for 26 years. I've never once, ever been called by a pharmacist asking me, what's the ICD-10 code associated with that patient? It has no relevance. It's none of their business. In fact, it's a HIPAA violation. And
why do they care?
No bearing on the medication. What's that?
Why do they care?
Well, because ivermectin, they were told, don't fill this. So they were saying if it was related to COVID, they were going to say no. So I would have had to tell them it's related to, you know, worms or something, that they have some parasite. But I'm like, it's none of your business. You've never called me about any other patient. And I've written for some heavy duty medications. I've never, ever been called. So this whole thing is so political. It's just mind boggling. And I stopped writing for it because I couldn't get it through.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, it's really, really odd. And do you think that, and this is an opinion of us lay people like me who have some pretty good knowledge of the medical profession, having supervised them at the executive level twice. Do you think the medical profession has hurt its credibility so bad that actually lives may be in danger because people don't trust them anymore because of all this?
Fantastic question. And I'm sorry that you had to supervise doctors because they're hard to supervise. I think, yes, unfortunately, yes, that a couple of bad actors have just destroyed, just like they've done for so many institutions throughout this country, be it the military, be it the, you know, the school system, whatever it is, a couple of bad actors have just ruined it for everybody else. And I think the same thing with medicine. Yes, the credibility of that noble, wonderful institution that we call medical care has been completely undermined. And it's such a shame because it is so important and it's such a noble pursuit and it's just such a wonderful thing. And these, I don't even know what to call them, terrible people have undermined that credibility that was once there. But you have people like Secretary Kennedy, like Peter McCullough, like Dr. Corey, these other people who have stood up throughout this entirety of this thing, and they got hurt for it, by the way. They were lambasted and they were, you know, made fun of and whatever, and lost privileges, and they didn't get criminally charged like me, but they had bad things happen to them too. But yet they still had the wherewithal to stand up to it. So there are people out there who are fighting the good fight and trying to do the right thing. But yeah, definitely. It's a great question. 100%.
Yeah, we've only got a couple minutes left. So tell folks what your next steps are, how they can help you, because you guys, you know, you've already spent millions of dollars on this. Can folks help you guys out? But what are your next steps as you go into August, is it, where your new trial is?
Yes. Well, so you can go to, first of all, thank you for asking. You can go to dropthecase.com, www.dropthecase.com. Please go there. There's a give, send, go there. If people can give, please, just even a couple dollars, because yes, these legal bills have been overwhelming and I'm now facing even more legal bills, and I will owe my lawyers until the day I die. I pay them a little bit every single month, and they're very gracious and wonderful about that, because they know I didn't do anything wrong and they stand behind me, but they still deserve to get paid. So I pay them what I can, as much as I can every single month. But if you can donate, I'd appreciate it. There's information on the website. You can follow me on X, Ron Elfenbein, MD, R-O-N-E-L-F-E-N-B-E-I-N, MD. There is a change.org, which is an online petition. If people could just sign it, it doesn't cost anything. But that's just another thing to send a message to the DOJ. Like, this is crazy. Just go pick on someone who deserves it and go find real criminals. So I'm doing whatever I can to prepare for trial. I can't believe that I have to do this again. I don't even know how I can go through it. I mean, the first time I could barely get out of bed and every morning, and I don't know how I'm going to do it a second time. They know that. That's, they try to break people because they know that most people can't stand up to this, and most people don't have the resources to stand up to this, and most people don't want to. So they cop a deal. And they know that, and they put pressure on you to do that kind of stuff. So I'm just really hopeful that this won't come to August, but You know, I mean, I got to do what I got to do. So I'm preparing and working hard with my team every single day.
Well, Doc, you got a lot of people praying for you and admire your courage and your strength and your determination. Honestly, I don't think the average American wants you to take a deal because they want to see you be acquitted again and show these people how wrong they are. So we're pulling for you. And we'll keep trying to get the story out, and we're praying for your family. I know you have kids, and your wife still works and everything. So we appreciate you, and we will get this story out and get it resolved in your favor, one way or the other. I firmly believe that. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Colonel. Thanks for having me, and I really appreciate everything you guys do.
You bet. Thanks, Doc. And Monday is More War Monday. I'll see you then on the Rob Mena Show.
You're watching Worldview 2, built on the 35 years of Worldview books, documentaries, research, high-profile interviews, and the radio